The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you, and it is November, and in November, the Dayton Literary Peace Prizes are awarded, and this year Susan Southard is recipient of the prize in nonfiction for her book Nagasaki: Life After Nuclear War. And we're going to talk to Susan Southard about this important book, about the second atomic bomb that fell on Nagasaki, Japan, 71 years ago. But first, NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Susan Southard. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Vic.
Susan, we had you on the program August of last year, which was the 70th anniversary of the bombing of the Japanese city Nagasaki near the end of World War II, and you had published a book at the time called Nagasaki: Life After Nuclear War. It's just come out this year in paperback, and it's just been named the recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction this year. You're going to be in town to receive your prize in November.
Yes, I am. It's not too far away. It's less than a month away now.
Were you surprised to hear that you had won?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely surprised and more thrilled than I can say, really.
Well, I thought you should win, and that's just after I read the book last year, I said this is such a strong book and should be considered, and I'm so happy for you.
Well, you mentioned that during our interview last year, and I told my researcher, but I didn't tell anybody else that you said that. And when I knew that I was a finalist, you know, before the, you know, a month or two before. But, you know, the candidates that were in the category were such fine authors and books that it was really, it could have gone to anyone, I think.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Susan Southard joins us. Her book is Nagasaki: Life After Nuclear War. In a way, this book began 30 years ago, but also in another way, it began even longer ago than that. Tell us how this happened.
How the book came about?
Yeah.
Well, the real origins, not really for the book, but for the impact of the Nagasaki atomic bombing, happened for me back in the 70s. I was a study abroad student in Japan for 13 months in high school. And I happened to go on the week-long school field trip with the senior class of my girls' high school to Kyushu, which is the southernmost main island of Japan. And we went to Nagasaki. At that time, the Nagasaki Atomic Bomb Museum was just on the fifth floor of an eight-story building on a hillside overlooking the hypocenter area of Nagasaki. It was the Nagasaki Cultural Hall, and the fifth floor was the museum. It has since been rebuilt, and it's a stunning architectural piece, as well as, of course, very impactful. And I stood there with my classmates, arm in arm, as Japanese girls did at the time. We always walked arm in arm together, and I was the only American in the group. And I had not yet learned about the atomic bombings in high school because of I had moved around, and so I had missed American history in one high school to the next. So I hadn't had 20th century American history yet. And I was devastated to see the photographs, the artifacts, a helmet with flesh still embedded in it from someone's skull. It was just very, very impactful for me as a young girl. But it impacted me personally, but I never thought about doing anything about that at the time. And very unexpectedly, some 12 years later, I was living in Washington, D.C., when a Nagasaki survivor named Taniguchi Sumiteru was in town on a speaking tour of the East Coast of the United States. And I went to hear him speak and was, again, deeply moved. He was very soft-spoken and had had a really quite horrific experience. His back was burned off. He was 16 at the time. And he was 57 when I met him. And I ended up being his interpreter for the last 2 days of his time in D.C. because his interpreter wasn't able to fulfill that commitment for some reason. So I got to spend a lot of time with him because I was the only person with him that spoke Japanese, and he spoke no English. So I got to talk with him in great depth about his experience, his perspectives on looking back on the bombing and how he felt about it then. So that would have been some, 41 years later. And that was the real seed of the book, because I went to Nagasaki and Hiroshima the next year to visit him, and I met survivors in both cities.
The first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Then the second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. And Hiroshima's the city that gets most of the attention. Nagasaki is not that well known. Why is that?
Yes, you're right. It isn't well known. In fact, a lot of people that I meet, kind of have a bit of a question mark in their expression when I mention the title, as if they're trying to make sure they know what the title means. I think it's for a number of reasons. One is historically, way back when the bombs happened, the Hiroshima bombing received major, bold headlines across national papers here in the United States, while the Nagasaki bombing took place on the same day, 11 hours after the Soviet Union entered the war against Japan. And so the Soviet invasion of Japanese-held Manchuria took the headlines, and Nagasaki took secondary place there. So that's way back. And then as time went on, the Hiroshima bombing represented the entrance into the nuclear age, and it was the first and thus the one that got most all the attention. Nagasaki really lives in its shadow, although certainly the people of Nagasaki now only care about, they don't have any issue with that anymore, if they did earlier on. Because the survivors, now their only priority is to try to abolish nuclear weapons from all nations across the world.
Susan Southern joins us. Her book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, which is the recipient this year of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction, and she'll be receiving her award this month in November. And you first came upon the survivor, Taniguchi, in 1986, he had been a teenager in Nagasaki when the bomb exploded, and you were able to interview a number of other survivors, including some primary interview subjects who you went into great depth with, who were all teenagers when the bomb was dropped. And it must have been difficult for you to find people to talk to, because this is kind of a subject that people don't want to discuss, isn't it?
Yes, you're really right about that. In Japan, the survivors, both in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, were very quiet for two specific reasons, or three maybe. One is that the trauma is so great that it's difficult to speak of, to even bring words to. And so often people never spoke of it again. It was so completely overwhelming. The second reason is because both in marriage and in employment, there was discrimination about toward those who survived. People not wanting to marry a hibakusha, which is the name for an atomic bomb-affected person, because of their long-term health prospects and because of the possibility of passing the genetic effects of whole-body radiation exposure to the children, to their children. And employers didn't want to hire them for the same reason, particularly for the long-term health effects. So people kept very quiet. And often husbands and wives didn't even know for years that the other was a survivor and didn't know the details of the trauma that that their spouse had experienced. So yes, it was difficult to... It wasn't difficult for me to find those subjects for my book because a small cadre of survivors made very personal and transformative decisions in their lives to speak out and tell their stories so that others can understand the humanitarian impact of the bombs and of nuclear war and to help in the effort to eliminate nuclear weapons. So among those, I was able to find amazing survivors who were willing to talk with me.
You were able to talk to these brave souls that had survived and endured and lived through so much suffering and just agony. And we're going to talk about some of these individuals. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Susan Southard. Her book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, has won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize this year in nonfiction. It's just out in paperback. We'll continue with The Book Nook right after this. It's The Book Nook on WYSO. Today, my guest is Susan Southard. She was on the program last year for the release of the hardcover of Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, and it has just won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. And Susan will be in Dayton to receive her award and to speak about the book this month in November. And she joins us on the telephone today from North Carolina. It's so nice to talk to you again. I'm so pleased that your book has gotten this kind of recognition, Susan. Let's talk about some of these individuals that you spoke to. And first of all, let's talk about the gentleman who you met 30 years ago who was innocently riding his bicycle on that terrible day in August 1945.
Mm. Yes, Mr. Taniguchi was 16. All students who were 14 and over by that time in the war were required to leave school and work in some capacity for the war effort, and his job was to deliver mail. So he was in the northwestern corner of the city of Nagasaki in the hills on his bicycle delivering mail, and the blast, wind, and heat, he was over a mile away, the blast, wind, and heat surged up to him and behind and hurled him off his bicycle, and ultimately, he didn't know it at the time because he was in such shock, slapped him down on the ground and basically burned his back off. And the level of injury and suffering he experienced is really beyond anything that I've ever known because he was hospitalized. He didn't even get any real medical attention until late November, a good 3 months after the bombing. And because there was no medical attention, no medical support capable of treating his injuries that were so severe. And eventually he was hospitalized north of the city in a naval hospital about 22 miles north, I'm not sure. And he was in the hospital for 3 years and 7 months, lying on his stomach in agony, begging the nurses to let him die.
And his stomach was in bad shape after lying that way, wasn't it?
Yes, he had bed sores that were so huge and so deep that they pierced into his body, and one of them you could see his heart beating.
And he's the gentleman who you met in 1986.
Yes,
and
it's so unusual because when he speaks in front of groups, he wears very beautiful suits and a tie, and he's very handsome man, and you can't tell what's underneath the massive scar tissue that he's that is beneath his clothing and that causes him suffering even today. He's 87 and a half now.
Let's talk about some of these other survivors that you had an opportunity to interview in depth. Who's next?
Let's talk about Nono Etsiko. She was 16 at the time of the bombing. And I don't want to say too much about her story because I don't want to give it away to the readers, for anyone who might read the book.
Sure.
But maybe I could tell that she's very, very beautiful woman, and she was far enough away from the bomb that she was not seriously injured. She was over the mountains that surround the major part of the city. But her home was very close to the hypocenter. And the reason I selected Mrs. Nagano for the book is because I needed to have a story that reflected the suffering of a family.
Mm-hmm.
The other stories, the other survivors whose stories I tell, all have different aspects of the larger story of survival, but I didn't have one about an intimate family story. And I'd like to leave it at that, except that she lived with the repercussions of that story for 50 years of additional suffering until things became resolved within her family. And it was a very deep and impactful experience for her all these years. And she still tells her story. She's also 87, and she is out there speaking to high school students in Japan very frequently. Still, I saw her in November speak in front of a huge auditorium of maybe 600 or 700 students.
Can we talk about the gentleman who was on the streetcar?
Yes, Mr. Wada. He was 18. He's the oldest of the five survivors whose stories I tell through the book. And Mr. Wada was a streetcar driver. That was his assigned job. And he was very lucky because there was a streetcar derailment that morning in Nagasaki, and that changed his route and his timing back to the terminal. Otherwise, he would have been very close to the hypocenter and would not have lived. So he was in the terminal a little more than 2 miles away from the hypocenter and was badly injured and suffered some of the minor impact of radiation exposure over the next few years, where he lost some hair and became ill. But he wasn't one of the ones who got the worst of it, one of the many tens of thousands who got the worst of it and died from the radiation exposure. And he was quite valiant. He helped in the immediate recovery efforts and then in helping to carry bodies to be cremated. He was one of the ones who worked in the city for months trying to help others in the immediate aftermath. And one thing that's really poignant about his that readers might like to know is that he has quite a lovely love story in his. It's a subdued love story, but nonetheless, it's very, very tender and sweet with him and his wife, who's also a survivor.
And was he the one who, when he married her, she didn't know that he had been in it and been injured?
No, that was Mr. Taniguchi.
Okay, that's right.
The one
whose
back was burned off.
And gotcha.
There's a very dramatic story of when his new wife on their first night of marriage discovered his injuries.
Gotcha. I haven't read the book since last year.
Yes,
I was confusing these guys. The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard wrote it. She joins us on the program today. Some of the victims of the blast at Nagasaki were still in their mother's wombs on the day of the explosion. How did this impact their lives?
Oh, it was very tragic what happened for the mothers and the babies. In the 9 months that followed the blast, the bombing, many pregnant women had spontaneous abortions and stillbirths and infant deaths. And then those babies that survived often developed microcephaly and other developmental disabilities from the radiation they experienced in the womb. And a lot of it depended on exactly what period of gestation they were in affected what kind of impact the radiation had on them once they were born. And so they grew up, you know, in a different situation than they would have without the bombing, that's for sure.
Tell us about that day and what happened.
Well, the primary target for the second atomic bomb was not Nagasaki. It was a city called Kokura, which is it's now merged and has become another. It doesn't go by that name anymore. It's merged with another city nearby, but it's on the northern coast of Kyushu, whereas Nagasaki is on the western coast toward the south. It's about 150 miles away, I think. And the plane, the boxcar, the plane carrying the second atomic bomb and the accompanying plane got to Kokura, and they have very strict orders to drop the bomb via a visual sighting of the city. But the city was covered in cloud and smoke cover. Clouds because of the weather, which had been staked out earlier by advanced planes, and it was clear, but there had been clouds and smoke from a nearby city that had been firebombed the day before by Allied forces. So they circled the city three times, trying to get some kind of a sighting. They couldn't. They were shot at, and eventually they were getting low on fuel, and they decided to head toward the secondary target, Nagasaki. And to their great dismay, as they approached Nagasaki, they saw that Nagasaki, too, was covered in clouds. And so at the last minute, they were going to drop the bomb by radar when the bombardier saw a small hole in the clouds and could see something of the city below and said, "I've got it, I've got it," and opened the bomb bay doors, and they released the bomb. It was not on the intended target, but it was over the city. And of course, to a great degree, nuclear weapons are not a specific target-oriented. They cause mass killing and mass destruction and mass injury. So a great deal of Nagasaki was annihilated in a single instant. Once it was detected by the civil defense teams, it was too late to really put out a warning to the city, and the staff of those civil defense and military defense teams just dived for cover at that point.
Susan Souther joins us. Her book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And it is the recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Nonfiction this year. And she joins us by telephone today from North Carolina. And she'll be in Dayton to receive her award in November. And they have a big ceremony for that in Dayton. And it's quite an event. There's a dinner and lots of speeches and lots of people dressed in their best clothing for this wonderful event. And it's sold out already, I understand, but wow, what a thing, and so happy that you won this award.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, my dad was at Nagasaki in the 2nd Division Marines. I mentioned this to you in our prior interview, and he never talked about that. He had a lot of photos, and I remember as a kid hearing from many people, other veterans of the conflict in the Pacific, that the nuclear bombs, the atomic bombs, were important, that they had stopped the invasion of Japan, that they had actually saved lives, and they were justified. My dad never said that, but I heard that from a lot of other people, and that seems to still be a prevailing viewpoint. What are your thoughts?
Well, yes, it is still the prevailing viewpoint. It's certainly what we're taught mostly in school, and that has been the case for the last 70 years. My thinking about it is that it's a far more complex historical issue than what we learned and what former Secretary of War Stimson in 1947, he published an article in the Atlantic Monthly basically justifying the use of the bombs in a very airtight and authoritative voice that really kind of closed the subject. It was intended to quiet opposition that was arising in our country. And it did that very well. And it created an official narrative that the bombs ended the war and saved you know, the numbers vary, but mostly I hear a million American lives and also Japanese lives by preventing an Allied invasion of the Japanese home islands. Well, it's far more complicated than that for two main reasons that I can say today. And one is that the Soviet Union entered the war 11 hours before the second bombing and before the Nagasaki bombing. And from all accounts that I was able to find, the cabinet was already in heated, the big six, the top six leaders of the military and Japanese government were already in another heated debate about whether to surrender or not. And, you know, half wanted to surrender and half wanted to fight to the end. And they did not that day, after they heard the news about the Nagasaki bombing. Nagasaki was not mentioned the whole day in these, first the big six meeting, and then they brought in the whole cabinet. And finally, after midnight, the emperor called cabinet members to his underground bunker and broke the stalemate and made the decision to surrender. But there's no indication that Nagasaki was part of that discussion. It was the Soviet invasion and maybe some about the Hiroshima bombing. So there's that question. There's also the fact that the Soviets invaded Japanese-held territory in Manchuria and entered the war against Japan completely changes the potential narrative for a land invasion of the Japanese home islands. Mm-hmm. And people never bring that into the story. So for those two reasons alone, the story is far more complex. And also, I researched really carefully what Secretary of War Stimson said in his justification for the bombs. And there was much that was accurate in what he said, but there was much that was inaccurate and a great deal omitted from the story that he put forth. And so we have lived with that narrative for most of these past 71 years with some historians really doing a great job of analyzing it, but it hasn't become part of the national awareness here in our country yet.
Mm. In case you're just tuning in, this is the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCuna. Susan Southard has returned to the program today to talk about her book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, just out in paperback, and recently announced as the recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. And Susan will be in Dayton to receive her award in November, and the Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Susan Southard joins us on the Book Nook today, and her book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, just out in paperback. Susan, during that last segment, we were talking about the narrative, how many residents of the U.S. have viewed the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki over the last 71 years. I have looked on Amazon.com and seen some of the reader reviews and comments about your book, and some of them seem to embrace that common narrative. Some of them are very critical of the story that you've written. I'm guessing that you encounter people like this over the past year that have things to say about the book. What's your experience been?
Yes, well, you're right, of course. The large majority of response to the book has been extremely positive. I get emails every week from readers who are grateful for the book, for the story, for the information, for the awarenesses that they now have about the atomic bombing of Nagasaki, which also includes parts of the Hiroshima story as well. That said, there is a smaller percentage of readers who write me. Actually, I don't think I should call them readers because I don't think most of them have read the book.
Mm.
Based on what they write, they give me a sense that they haven't read the book. They are very angry and very vehemently express anger toward the existence of the book, that we shouldn't be listening to these stories, that we should have. Some of them are very, very angry, outraged, and some of them are a little bit more measured, that they or their father or their grandfather was saved by the bomb because they were scheduled to be a part of the land invasion of Japan.
Mm.
But others say things like they bombed us first. This is they deserved it. Mm-hmm. Pretty strong sentiments, which I understand the outrage against Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor. And of course, my book is not an apology for that or for Japan's atrocities in China, the military's torture and killing of Allied POWs. There's no question that the Japanese military was absolutely horrific in many respects. That said, I think even if someone is wanting to defend the decision to use the atomic bombs, I think it's important to know the whole story. That without the whole story, we are closing ourselves off to the impact of our actions. And I think that that's an incredibly important thing to do as individuals and as a country.
Well, I hated to even mention that, but it's part of the story. And I think
it's true. It is part of the story.
If people actually read your book with an open mind, they will see that this is reportage, that you are a journalist here, that you are not taking sides. You are reporting.
Yes, that's so true. I'm not taking sides. And the book took 12 years of travel to Nagasaki, interviews, translation, research, and the writing. And it's very carefully done. And my intention is to tell the other side of the story, that remarkably the enduring impact of post-nuclear survival has never been told. And it's important for us, not only for history, but for our present-day circumstances, with ours and other countries' continuing nuclear buildup, with the possibilities of other nations either on purpose or accidentally using nuclear weapons, or terrorists getting a hold of it, or accidents happening. All of these things are very possible in our world today, and I think it's important for us to understand the story of what happens after a nuclear weapon is detonated, not just some vague image, but the specifics of it. And of course, the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs were far less powerful than the ones that are in our stockpiles today.
The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard wrote it. It recently was issued in the paperback. And she joins us by telephone today from North Carolina. And the book is the winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize this year for nonfiction. And I'm guessing that during these days, as you prepare to come to Dayton for the ceremony, that you're working on your acceptance speech. What are you planning to say?
Actually, I haven't begun that yet.
Okay.
I have some thoughts about it, but I have two deadlines next week, writing deadlines that I need, or three actually, that I need to complete before I can begin the work on the speech. I do think one thing I may bring in is that yesterday we had an historic moment in the United Nations where a majority of nations voted on a resolution to meet next year to negotiate a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. None of the nuclear nations signed on to that, but the possibility of an international treaty is a very important step toward the elimination of nuclear weapons. So hopefully I'll be able to bring the importance of this story in my book to the present day right now.
Well, Susan, we do appreciate the fact that you took some time out of your busy schedule with all these deadlines to talk to us today on the program. I just really wanted to interview you before you came to Dayton. What are these projects you're working on?
Well, I am writing a book review, the book called Nothing Ever Dies, which is by the same author that won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize in fiction, The Sympathizer.
Oh.
So I'm writing that right now. It's a phenomenal book. About war and memory and how we remember and the power of memory, the power relationships of memory. And so I have that due on Tuesday. And I have a grant due for some work for the city of Nagasaki due on Thursday. And then I am writing a short chapter for a book for the United Nations that's due the following Monday.
Wow.
So those are the projects.
You are busy.
Busy week.
That's a grant proposal that you're writing?
Yes.
Okay.
The city of Nagasaki has selected a number of people who are involved in anti-nuclear efforts, which I haven't been an anti-nuclear activist per se, and don't consider myself so, but I do have a voice in this story. So they have grants available over the next few years to help spread the message of why it's important to consider the elimination of nuclear weapons. It's the only weapon of mass destruction that's still legal in the world.
Susan Souther joins us. Her book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. This is the Book Nook on WYSO, and we produce the Book Nook right here in the studios of WYSO. Susan, I don't want to talk too much about this particular woman that you interviewed. I know you kind of want to save that for readers, but she's the one who, when you walk, she walks in the room and you see her from afar for the first time, you're just stunned, right? Isn't that the woman?
Actually, no.
Oh, is that the other woman?
That's the woman you're mentioning.
Okay, let's talk about her then.
This woman, her name is Do Mineko.
Okay.
She was 15 at the time of the bomb, and when I first met her, you're remembering that, it was just astounding to me. I was sitting in a conference room in the Nagasaki Atomic Bomb Museum, and she came in the other end of this long, narrow room and took my breath away. She stood there with so much, very straight, regal posture and beautifully dressed. She had designed her own clothes, and from afar, I couldn't see the slight disfigurement of her face. And she was absolutely stunning and articulate and outspoken, strong, passionate woman who has an incredible story of injury, radiation illness, and long-term hiding in her home because her hair fell out. She eventually recovered from most of her injuries and from her near-death experience with radiation exposure in 1946, it takes its toll on the body, and many people died, and she was at the brink of death, but she, she didn't die. But her hair fell out, and it didn't grow back for almost 10 years.
Mm.
So she stayed hidden in her house for 10 years. And then what happened after that, her decisions in her career and how she chose to live her life, is unlike any other survivor I met or read about. And I hope that readers will read the book and hear her story and be as inspired by her as I was.
Wasn't she the one who was working in the factory?
Yes, she was in the Mitsubishi Weapons Factory. It was a torpedo factory. There was no military base in Nagasaki, but there were weapons factories. Nagasaki is a Mitsubishi town, was a Mitsubishi town, still is to some degree. And the factory was not too far from the hypocenter. And the entire massive factory where thousands of men, women, and young children were working, not young children, but teenagers were working, collapsed. And the massive room where she was in imploded on top of her and the hundreds of others in the room. And the story of her escape from that factory alone is eerie, and when I would listen to the tapes of her telling me about it, it would raise the hair on my arms. It was so riveting and scary.
And she's also the one, I think, who, after she died, her family found that painting, and she...
Yes, you have such a good memory, Vic.
Yeah, and she'd written on the bottom as a picture of a purple iris, and she'd written in calligraphy, "Thank you for a good life."
Yes, I have a beautiful color photocopy of that framed and hanging in my house. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. In her retirement, she became an artist, and she always had written poetry, mostly Japanese haiku and tanka. And she was a beautiful calligrapher, and she wrote, she did her own watercolor painting of iris flowing up. It's small. It's like the size of a piece of paper. Mm. And then in calligraphy from the right going down, thank you for a good life, and signed her name and has her red name signature stamp. That also took my breath away, that she could come to the end of her life having had nuclear war be a defining moment and be grateful for her life.
Well, this is a very powerful story and a very well-written, well-researched book. It's Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, and I'm so glad the judges for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize were apparently as impressed by it as I am, because, wow, what a book.
Thank you so much, Vic. I really appreciate that. And I'm so honored to have received the Dayton Literary Peace Prize and can't wait to be in Dayton. In fact, I don't know if your listeners know this, but the Boxcar is the name of the B-29, the modified B-29 that delivered the bomb to Nagasaki, is in Dayton at the Air Force Museum there.
I think you'd be amazed how many people in Dayton know that.
Meaning most people do?
That's a very popular place.
I'm very excited, too.
Don't be sorry, but it's true. And aviation history is big here. Of course, the Wright brothers.
Yeah.
You might have heard of them. They
I think I have.
they love their airplanes here in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Great.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to a free morning or afternoon to going to the Air Force Museum.
Well, I know that you've got a lot of activities scheduled around you while you're in town, and the awards banquet is already a sellout. But I understand that there's another situation where someone might come and hear you speak that doesn't have a ticket to the awards banquet. Are you going to be a part of that conversation with the Dayton Literary Peace Prize winners?
Yes, I will be. I believe that is on Sunday morning.
I have the info.
November 20th.
I have the info right here.
At Sinclair College.
Yes, it's 9 o'clock Sunday, November 20th at the Ponet Center, Building 12, North End Auditorium, Sinclair College on West 4th Street in Dayton. And reservations are required by Wednesday, November 16th. And you can RSVP to this email address, peaceliterature@att.net. That's peaceliterature@att.net if you'd like to attend the conversation with the 2016 Dayton Literary Peace Prize winners. So I was ready to announce that. Just I wanted to make sure you were going to be there, Susan.
Yes, I will. I'm very much looking forward to it. And more information may also be available on the Dayton Literary Peace Prize website.
Gotcha. Well, Susan, thank you so much for coming back to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Vic. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard wrote it. It recently came out in paperback. And not only did it win the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction this year, but there's a nice little stamp on the cover of the paperback. It says winner of the Lucas Book Prize. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, thank you so much for asking. The Lucas Book Prize is a annual prize for a nonfiction book that's relevant to American history and society. It's administered and given by the Columbia University School of Journalism and Harvard University's Nieman Foundation for Journalism. So it's a fabulous honor that I received last spring when I went to Harvard to receive it. So incredible. And the other authors, there's a history prize, there's a book prize, a history prize, and a work in progress prize each year. Mm. And the other books that won were incredibly interesting, as are the authors who will participate in the Dayton Peace Prize panels and award ceremonies and stuff. I'm so honored to be a part of these activities next month.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Vic. Take care.
That was Susan Southard talking about Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And it is the recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. Susan will be in Dayton this month to attend the awards ceremony. And this is always a big event in Dayton, and she has written quite a book. It recently came out in paperback. And back in August of last year, around the 70th anniversary of the atomic bomb blast in Nagasaki, we had Susan on the program for the hardcover release of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And I was so impressed with this book. I mentioned to her that I really thought that this book was worthy of consideration for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize in nonfiction. And the book ended up being submitted for consideration, and it was one of the finalists. And as you know, it is the winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. So we went back into our archive and pulled out the segment of the interview where I suggested to Susan that I thought that this was a worthy book for consideration for the prize, and she had a wonderful reaction. She certainly did not expect her book to be the winner over a year ago when I first mentioned it to her. Let's listen now to that excerpt from the interview, the original interview with Susan Southard, as she talks about Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, in the Book Nook.
Yoshida Katsuji, the young boy who was 13 and whose face was disfigured, he would get up in front of school children, and at first they cried, and he was mortified, and he could barely tolerate it. He wanted to speak about his experience and teach them about peace, but at first he couldn't. But after a while, he got more comfortable and very, very sweet, and he would tell them jokes at first to make them laugh. And one of the things that really touched me about his way of talking with children is he would say, "Have you ever looked up the word heiwa, which is the Japanese word for peace, in the dictionary?" Mm. And no one in the audience ever had. And the children, he said, "Let's look it up." And he would read the definition. And then he would look at them and say, you know, or he said to me, "They don't know this because they're in peacetime." But he said, "We need to pay attention to peace." And he teaches that to them. And he brought a different level of awareness to me when he said that we are not in peacetime, but in the United States we are. I mean, the wars that the United States is fighting and struggling with in regions across the Middle East and Afghanistan are outside of our territory. And I think it's important for all of us to pay attention to what supports and maintains peace, even though we are, as a nation, we're not at peace. It's not the same situation. But as we consider various military actions, I guess, in areas of the world that are threatened right now.
The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard wrote it here in Dayton, Ohio, where we had the Dayton Peace Accords. We now have what we call the Dayton Literary Peace Prizes for literature. They're for fiction and nonfiction. And I think you need to be sure to tell your publisher to submit your book next year for consideration.
Thank you so much.
Okay?
That's very kind of you, Vic. Thank you.
I think this is a very powerful book, and I think it fits right in with what they're looking for. That was Susan Southard talking about her book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, which has just been named the recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. And that was an excerpt from the interview I did with Susan in August of 2015, when the book had just come out in hardcover. And I suggested that I thought it would be a worthy book to be considered for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. And I am absolutely delighted that it is the winner of the prize this year. And the event when she will be receiving her award, the dinner and awards banquet, is a sellout. If you're going, I hope you have a pleasant evening there. It's quite an event. And if you're not going and you'd like to hear her talk, there is an event happening that is open still, and you can attend on Sunday, November 20th at 9 o'clock in the morning, a conversation with the 2016 Dayton Literary Peace Prize winners. And this is taking place at the Ponet Center at Sinclair College, Building 12, North End Auditorium, West 4th Street in Dayton. You will need to make a reservation, and you can do that. You can RSVP if you do it by Wednesday, November 16th, to peaceliterature@att.net. peaceliterature@att.net is the email address to reserve a spot. That's November 20th at 9 o'clock in the morning. And that is a conversation with the 2016 Dayton Literary Peace Prize winners. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for listening, and go in peace.